Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, and on Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Adam Leshinsky, Assistant Managing Editor of Fortune Magazine and the head of our Silicon Valley coverage. And I'm your moderator for today's program. Before I introduce our speaker, I believe you'll have cards where you can write down your questions and send them up to the front during the course of our conversation. I will tell you right now that there are points for legibility. The better your penmanship, the more likely it is that your question will get read by me. And it is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Jack Welch, former chairman and CEO of General Electric, and co-author with his wife, Susie Welch, of The Real Life MBA, your no BS guide to winning the game, building a team, and growing your career. This is the part where I'm supposed to give a prepared a few comments about who Jack Welch is, and I'm going to go ahead and make the assumption that anybody who pays and has paid the slightest amount to the world of business over the past 4 or 5 or 6 decades already knows who Jack Welch is. So with having gotten that out of the way, I will ask you to join me in welcoming Jack Welch.
Thank you. Thank you.
Jack, it's good to see you again.
Adam, great to be here.
Thank you. Jack and I have appeared on television together from time to time. It's always a great deal of fun. I actually didn't bring Jack's current book, but I did bring his book from 2011 called Jack Straight from the Gut.
2001.
Excuse me, 2001. Thank you. It came out on September 11th, 2001.
Right.
That was in my head. And it's a book that holds up extremely well to this day. Fascinating book. So given that I assume from my tone and our friendliness that I've already established for the audience and for you my deep respect for you, I'm gonna ask you an impertinent question to get things going.
Right.
The other day, the San Francisco Chronicle referred to you as being crotchety.
Yeah.
And tell everybody what a guy who retired from a very important job a number of years ago. You are not quite an octogenarian, but you're getting awfully close.
Right.
What do you have to say about people's careers today?
Well, I have a lot to say about how you get out of the pile. We have a lot in this book about if you're stuck in your job. The problem we have right now in business, particularly since the 2008 recession, is the grind of business. Now, in Silicon Valley, when I say this, it sounds silly because everything here is free food, free everything. do whatever you want.
But You've been to Google, apparently.
Yes. I've been to Google and LinkedIn and other places. But as you go across the country, you see the grind and the difficulty that this recession has taken out of people. Google, for example, Gallup runs a poll every quarter on people's attitude toward work and their business and their jobs. And it turns out that 65% of Americans since the recession are disengaged. Well, if you believe like I believe that business is a game, the team that feels the best players wins, and you got 65% of the people on the sidelines frowning, disengaged. Now, that's not quite appropriate here, of course, but across the country it is. And this survey has been going on since 2008, and it's not improving. So people, when my wife and I go around the country and ask people, how many in the room, and we've talked to over 1.25 million people in the last 10 years, Q&A sessions. And we ask them, how many of you know where you stand in your work? We don't get 15% of the crowd. Appraisals aren't straightforward. People don't know where they stand. There's not the engagement. So this book, a lot about this book, is how to get the team engaged, how to get everybody on the playing field, how to excite groups, how to grow people. We talk a lot of different techniques in here for dealing with leadership and getting gangs together to where you can have in your business area, your place can be the cool kid's basement. Jack, where it's fun to hang out.
Can you talk a little bit about who you see as the target reader for this book? And I'm wondering specifically the difference between people who consider themselves to have careers as opposed to people who go to work.
Well, I think it involves just about everybody. If you've got a BA in history and you want to know what big business is all about, this gives you a primer on what a practical needs of finance, of marketing, and other things. But it also tells you about how to grow your career, how to outdo, how to over-deliver, how to do things you need to get out of the pile. So it's applicable to everybody, from CEO to somebody stuck in a job. Absolutely, we call it, in this book, we call it purgatory, career purgatory, where you're stuck. You got a horse's neck for a boss. He's not.
Did you say a horse's neck?
Yes.
Got it.
I'm in San Francisco. I'm not in Boston. So basically, we talk about how to move your career when it's stuck in a trench. So we've got everybody can benefit from that. There isn't a book out there that says this is what an MBA almost is. It isn't enough. An MBA is better to have an MBA, but this gives you a feel for what it generally feels like.
So go ahead and give us one general piece of advice for when you feel like your career is stuck. And then we'll get to the horse's neck of a boss. But first, when your career is stuck, what's a general way of approaching that?
Well, first of all, you got to put a time limit on it. You got to know what credentials you have. Now, some people stay stuck because they've got family issues, they can't move, they don't want to disrupt their life, etc. But let's assume you're ambitious and you're stuck. You put a time frame on it, say a year, I'll put up with this for a year or two, whatever it is. You decide what it is. While you're there, you don't act like somebody's stuck. You don't say, oh, this place stinks. You don't join the little group over in the corner whispering and nattering. You instead over-deliver. You always give your boss more than your boss asks for. Your boss asks you to do X, you give him X plus Y. And you make your boss smarter. Every encounter with your boss, every encounter an employee has with a boss, should be aimed at making the boss come out of the meeting saying, holy cow, they made me smarter. I learned something from that encounter. Don't just regurgitate back the assignment. So that's one method. Make it clear to the boss, I'd like to understand how I'm doing. Now, don't go in and say, I haven't had a GD appraisal in ages. But you go in and you say, you know, I'd like to understand what you think I'm doing well and what you think I can do to improve. And focus on the improvement so they don't feel threatened. And you get a conversation going about why you might be stuck. And you draw them out. That's the type of conversation you have. Not this, I haven't gotten a raise in 18 months. It's about time I get a raise, you know. That ain't going to work. It ain't going to work.
Now, Jack, flip it around. You're the manager of somebody who's stuck. You know they're stuck. You know they're unhappy. It's very important to you that you solve this problem. What do you do?
Well, you do everything you can. Because if you're the right kind of boss, and I'll talk about something here that is very real in my experience. When I go through and think of people who have been successful that I've worked for and who haven't been that I've worked for, I think there's one ingredient that every good leader has, and you can think about this. It's called the generosity gene. They love to see you do well. They love to share your good ideas with others. They don't steal your idea and take it to their boss. They're excited for you. It turns them on to give you a raise. It turns them on to give you a stock option. That boss is always looking out for you. Now, if you don't have that boss, and I've been with bosses that didn't have that characteristic at all, and I tried like hell to get out of there as fast as I could. But that's something you got to look for. You want a boss who's interested in taking you to the next level, in growing your career, who gets turned on by your success. I'm more turned on about the fact that we've got over 50 CEOs of major companies who work for me out there today, at Boeing and Honeywell and Home Depot and all these places. That's a turn-on. That's the exciting stuff. All these people's lives were changed. And that, I hope you'll look, think through your bosses for a minute. Who was trying to help you move on? Who was trying to grow you? Who was giving you different experiences to make you broader and better? Well, you can think about that, but that's a gene that I find universal in good leaders.
Did you ever find somebody in your organization who was good in all sorts of ways but wasn't a generous person? They just, in their bones, they weren't? And how did you deal with that?
Well, they finally, in the end, those people only go to a certain level. That's without question. They get stuck because people will not rally around them. In the end, your job is not defined by how smart you are. It's defined by how good the people that work for you do and how well they do, and you regain your glory from the reflected glory of their performance. That's what leadership's all about. It's not about you having all the ideas. It's about how many people can you galvanize to take the hill with you and who are bright and smart and good.
Did you have a, does GE or did GE have a culture of individual contributors, and do you ever try to steer somebody that way instead of encouraging them to be a manager,
yeah,
be a leader?
Absolutely, and it's a little bit of a phony in a way. I mean, we always talked about, in every company, they always talk about this two ladders, the technical guy. I think today's technology is so complex and so fast-moving that it's much more likely today out here. I think out here you'd probably have technologists go all the way up the pipe as great technologists, whether it be Mirfield at Microsoft or the equivalents in all these other companies. But in those days, we always had that path, but it was never really the same lucrative position to get to as the managerial path.
And in your book, you talk about, as a manager, dealing with different kinds of employees. Could you talk about that?
Well, I think one of the things that we talk about a lot is when you think about where a business is going, think for a minute. First of all, you've got to have a mission. Where am I going and why am I going there? Secondly, you've got to have how do I get there? And that's what I call behaviors or values. Speed, share ideas, grow people, whatever the five or six key values you have in your company. And then the consequences of getting there, good or bad, how far you get. Well, when I talk about values, I always talk about five key things. And then there's, on one axis, you pick out the values. They can be speed, if your business needs speed. They can be share ideas with each other if you want to get collaboration across boundaries. They can be promotes and grows people. That can be a value. And you get these five things, whatever they are. And then you have performance on the other axis. That's the numbers, sales quotas, sales net income, productivity, whatever function you're in across the bottom. Now you look at these people and you say, you draw quadrants. And there are four quadrants. Low to high on the bottom, low to high going up the axis. You get high on the right. That's great values, just what you want to get the team going. You're on the team and delivering great results. That's easy, onward and upward. Then you get in the lower quadrant, low performance numbers, and not behaving the way you want, the way the company wants. That's low. That's easy, too. It's time to remind them they belong somewhere else. And then you've got in the middle here now, you've got the person with the great performance. No, you've got the person with the great values, but having a tough time. They can have a sick kid. They can have all kinds of issues for a month, a quarter, a year, maybe 2 years. Give them a second chance because they've got the values to be on your team. They buy into the mission. They know where you're going. They're behaving right. They deserve every chance in the world to deliver the numbers. But it's the horse's ass on the fourth quadrant that kills you. Because that's the person with the numbers and behaves like a jerk. Kisses up, kicks down, does all those things, that type four. And when companies keep that person, it's disaster. And so a boss is out giving speeches about values and how important they are. This person has none of them. But he's delivering the numbers every quarter. One more quarter. Give me some more. You know, give me another nickel. And you promote that person, you're dead. Remember, every promotion you ever make, remember this more important than anything, tells you more about a person than 100 speeches. Because guess what? Everybody in the organization knows what quadrant everybody's in.
They know intuitively, right?
No, they do it at their kitchen table at home.
Yeah.
At night, they're talking to a spouse back and forth about, and they know it. And you put a bad person in the job, you've just killed it. So don't start talking about values are important, behaviors are important. We care about that. And then you promote the jerk who gets the numbers and doesn't behave right. You're dead.
So you got rid of those people during your time?
Not all of them.
Jack, what in all seriousness, what percentage of business leaders do you think subscribe to that and follow through on that? I'm asking you, how prevalent is it in the business world to keep those people around?
Too often people keep them. The short-term results need the extra nickel. And the credibility just wilts away on you. But I'll tell you, when you take them out and you explain it, we had this thing in place for a long time, but until we took out 5 senior people in 1 year and then explained to 500 people in the crowd why they left, they didn't leave to go home and spend more time with the family. And we explained exactly why they left. One absolutely didn't want to buy a passport, even. He didn't want to get a passport. And we're talking about a global company, okay? And one was absolutely gender ridiculous, could not support women in the business, just couldn't get their head around it. And we said it publicly to 500 leaders at our annual meeting. And good people, good results, they just didn't have the characteristics that we wanted. And when you do that and you take out top people for that, everybody starts, you get the actions you reward and you get the actions you punish.
So I'm going to come to the subject of MBAs in just a moment. But first, I want to try to have a conversation about this amorphous topic called work-life balance. And I want to set it up by saying,
I wish my wife were here for this one. I usually get in trouble on this one.
But you know, I'm an employee who I think I'm bright and ambitious and I think I'm good and I really like this job, but frankly, I don't want to move to New Mexico and I don't want to go to dinner 4 nights a week and there's a whole bunch of things I don't want to do that I perceive I have to do to succeed in your organization. What do I do and what do you do?
Well, first of all, I have to assess your value. Then
in other words, why do I not want to move to New Mexico?
No. How important are you to the whole system? Because there are consequences to your... There's no such thing as work-life balance. It's the dumbest word ever put out there. There are work-life choices.
Choices.
Choices. You make choices, and choices have consequences, good or bad. But you make those consciously. And men have to make them, and women have to make them. You're talking about travels, dinner at night. There's a period, the childbearing years of women, that they have to make a lot of conscious choices. Some stay working, some don't. But all the decisions are their own, and they're good. No one's challenging their decision. But you got to get the consequences of it. If you're not available, it's an absolute fraud to be standing here and say, if you're not available in the clutch moments, in the crisis when we're sitting around the table trying to figure out the biggest problem we got, and you're unavailable, availability is a value. And if you're not there, they're going to pick somebody who is there. That's what's going to happen. It isn't even realistic to think that they're not going to.
But I get it, and I think everybody, I see a lot of head nodding, so I think everybody gets it, so let me take it a step further. But my kids' talent show is tomorrow night, and that is really important to me. And furthermore, you want people like me who care about my family.
Absolutely, and there'll be times when your kids' talent show will be far more important than anything at work. Far more important.
But it can't be every time, is what you're saying.
It can't, well, it depends. It's going to depend on how you manage your time. If you're there and available in all kinds of crisis, and then you have 5 days in a row that you got to do something different, do it, because you're valuable. But you got to decide your value, and they've got to decide how much they need you available. And that's a choice that you're going to make, and somebody's going to make a decision. I don't have any personal animosity to you not being there for a week. I mean, who cares if you're getting the job done somehow? So it's not something that's anything other than that. It's your decision, and you've got to make some, and you'll make some on the right side of the coin, you'll make some the wrong side of the coin. My wife, if she were here, she's in Seattle doing the Microsoft conference today. And one of the things that she tells a lot of stories of, because she was a working mom from the first day, four kids, and she tells stories of screwing up and making the wrong choices, and has a much better handle on some of this than I do. But I know the reaction from the boss's side. I know that if you're taking care of your family or whatever issue you have, male or female, if you're a star performer, you get all the leeway in the world. You get a bank of chits. But if your bank is empty, you can't call your chit out, okay? So you put stuff in the bank all the time with your performance. And then you make the choices based on the size of the jar.
Okay, Jack, MBAs. Please, go ahead.
Raise your hand. I mean, do anything. Yell at me. I mean, how do you feel about it? Is this crazy or is this reality?
The format of the program discriminates against the audience. I'm the audience's representative, but you did get some feedback there. But all right, MBAs, are we for them or against them?
I'm for them.
Okay, but not all of them.
No, I'm for all of them. I'm for all of them. I'm saying there's a relative value to an MBA. If you can afford, if you got rich parents and a rich uncle or an aunt, and you can get yourself placed at Harvard or Stanford in the MBA program, that'll cost you out of pocket 100 and something plus 200 of lost wages on a leafy campus for 2 years. Hallelujah.
This does not sound like a ringing endorsement to me.
No, it is. Because what happens at those schools is you've got recruiters piling in there because they want that credential. They want somebody with that credential. And it's extremely valuable. Now, as you go down the chain into state schools and other things, it becomes more difficult. The credential isn't quite as valuable, and the recruiters aren't quite as many. So the value proposition starts to change. Your $300,000, that's still $300,000.
To go to a second-tier school, a second-tier business school.
I don't want to call it second-tier. I'd say not in the top 25, okay? It costs you the same $300,000, but what's the return? You know, the idea behind our school, and we have a number of graduates here today.
Tell everyone what you're talking about when you say our school.
Oh, I have an online school called the Jack Welch Management Institute. I put it in place. I taught at MIT for 5 years after I retired, and I had a great class. I loved it. I loved the place, Sloan School. And we had 40 students in the class, and we had 500 applicants every semester, so it was a popular course. But it was frustrating that only 40 kids were doing it. And that's all I could get in the class. That's all they would have in a class. And so I decided to start an online school. And we have built an online school in the last 4 years, from 2010 to 5 years now, from one student to 900 students. And we're growing 40% a year. and it's incredible. Now, our school is different. It's all online. The average age of the student is 38. It costs $39,000. They stay working. In order to join the school, you must be employed. The student, and I have a number of them here if you get a chance to talk to them, the student is the customer. That is the unique difference of my school than every place else. Because every place else, the faculty is the student. It's the customer. Yep. And as a result of that, we run an NPS twice a quarter where the students decide how much they're learning. Look, they're 38 years old. They're spending their money. They're grown adults. They're making a decision. Am I learning enough to play in this game?
Excuse me. The NPS is, would you recommend this to someone else? Is that...
Would you recommend this program, Net Promoter Score, mm-hmm. would you recommend this to somebody else? Mm-hmm. Now, places like Amazon and Southwest Airlines have ratings up in the 75 to 80, and we're in the 80-plus range. So our students love what they're getting. The faculty is asked to leave if they get two negative NPS scores from the students. They're asked to leave. We have no tenure. We have no tenure policy. And it's a whole different game. It's run like a business. But the idea is, people say to me, why did you do that? Why didn't you give your brand to a big, wonderful branded school? Because if I did that, we couldn't experiment like we are. The faculty committee would tell me what course I had to have. They'd take my $10 million and they'd say, thank you, we'll put a sign up over the door, use your name on it. Now get the hell out of here. Okay, but we're not doing that. We're actually working. I work with these faculty every day. I work with all the school. We got a course to teach. We teach you on Monday. You practice it on Tuesday, and you hopefully share it on Friday. But it's real learning. And 65% of our people get promoted while they're in school in their company. And the average raise is 18%, and they got a whole different lifestyle. They're not in debt up to their eyeballs. And it's a program that is just, I love it. I love it because I think education is broken. Education needs to go more online with high school and other places. We got to get the cost down because middle-class families are being squeezed out of the education game. Either that or they're getting debt that's so bad it's strangling them. I think this model eventually, in some form, will go everywhere. That's the school.
Jack,
I'm not against MBAs. Everyone thinks I'm not against them at all.
To play the devil's advocate, convince me that we need business education at all. You know, I wrote some names down on my way over. Bill Gates.
It's folklore out here. Basically, yeah. why don't we all quit school as sophomores and start again and just
I'm happy to have that conversation, but I'm asking a different question, which is to say that can't business be learned well through a combination of doing and reading as opposed to, you know, going to class?
Well, of course. It can be done in all kinds of ways. And there can be kids at 17 years old who drop out of school and start a company. Of course, all those things can happen. But if you're in a company, if you're working, are you better prepared to manage people, to appraise people, to build winning teams if you've been through it in a robust education process that got you there? That's the question. I think yes. Now, do you need 2 years at $300,000? That's another question. As I said before, if you got the right family connections.
Could you share among the actual curriculum a few of the the skills that you think are critical? And I'll give you an example. I'm a business journalist. I meet business journalists all the time who've never taken an accounting class. Now, I'm not an expert on accounting, but I have taken an accounting class, and I think it's critical to understanding business.
Right.
What are some of the skills that people can acquire at the Jack Welch Management Institute?
Certainly how to hire, how to ask somebody to leave. Firing is a very difficult thing to do. It's the toughest thing you'll ever do in your life. And you got to have things like you got to have a philosophy where you love them on the way out as much as you loved them on the way in. Your severance costs will be the cheapest money you've ever spent because you've got a friend, or you've at least tried to make a friend on the way out who will be a customer or a reference or whatever. We teach two accounting courses that are very real, but we spend a lot of time on variance analysis. The most important thing in finance is not DCF and all those fancy numbers, DCRR, this and that and the next thing, which you get killed in all these terms, if you will. It's variance analysis. How did you do against last month, against last year? How are you going to do against next year? You want to spend X number of dollars in my marketing? How much is it more than you spent the year before? And what are the sales going to be from that? Live in variance analysis. We teach our students live in variance analysis. Because if you're going to be a manager, everything comes out of questions from variance. And don't get all tied up in terms you'll never use if you're not on Wall Street. So there's lots of things that we teach marketing, A-B testing, how to do that. We teach crisis management. How to deal with a crisis? How do you handle the various steps of that? So it's a very practical.
You when you retired from GE, you were known as the guru of corporate America, the corporate world. Talk about your view of this concept that is so popular today, especially around here, of entrepreneurialism and the cult of the entrepreneur and the startup.
You know, I'll give you a comment here, and I don't want you to take this wrong, but the word entrepreneur, unfortunately, has spread not just here, but across the country. And we've been at Harvard, we've been at MIT, we've been in Chicago, we've been in all these great schools in the last 3 weeks. And kids come up to you in the line when you're signing a book, and you ask them, what are you going to do? I want to be an entrepreneur. And then you say, and what's your idea? Well, something in tech, I don't know what yet. Entrepreneur is not a profession. It's not doctor or lawyer. It's somebody with a spirit who has an idea and is willing to go all the way to kill for it, okay? That's what an entrepreneur is. It's not a profession. And the word is becoming a profession. And too many people are going to be disappointed by that. God bless all the people that hit the jackpot. And I love the fact they keep trying. That's great. But the entrepreneurs that count have an idea. The dream may not be fulfilled, but they have the idea. And when kids come out and just say, I want to be an entrepreneur, it's not enough.
Flip side of that, don't you think that some people don't really have an idea, but they go into the GE management training program, but they don't know what they don't have an idea either, but that's okay?
It's a different thing. They're in a structure. It's a warm bath. Okay? as an entrepreneur, you're not in a warm bath.
Is there anybody in the room who worked at General Electric? I know there is somebody. Keep your hands up if you felt about it as a warm bath. Well, one person kept their hand up. All right, we could keep going, the two of us, but first, I want to remind our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Jack Welch, former chairman and CEO of General Electric, who is discussing, among other things, how we can all achieve success in our careers. I'm Adam Leshinsky, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. All right, we have a ton of questions from the audience in the room, and I'm going to try to get through as many of them as possible right now. First one, Jack. Today's employment path for the younger generation seems to be this. Change jobs every couple years. Is this good or bad for companies and or the employee and or for the country?
Well, let's say for the employee, if you've got skills that aren't being rewarded where you are and you've got the courage to keep moving, I encourage you to keep doing it. For the employer and the manager, it's your job to make that place so exciting, so enticing, so alive that no one wants to leave. No one wants to leave. I mean, that was the case in GE in the 80s and 90s. No one left. We had an incredible run. Stock went up 6,000%. Everybody, 60,000 people had stock options. Everybody was in the game, and it was an exciting time. But your job, and we talk about this in the book, is to make your group, whether it's 5 people or 10, the place where people want to hang out, the cool kids' basement. You want to do that. You want to have fun there. You want to reward your people. You want to reward them with praise in the soul and dollars in the wallet. Both sides count, and you want to be all over making it the place to be.
I'm going to read this word for word. What one invention are you pissed was not brought to market during your tenure as GE CEO? What was the one that got away?
I'm stumped. I really don't know the one that nobody told me about.
Well, didn't a competitor ever bring something to market that you think GE should have?
Oh yeah, we got leapfrogged and then we leapfrogged them back. That's part of that happened all the time. I mean, you're always trying to stay one step ahead, but sometimes we got leapfrogged, absolutely. We were too slow on the wide body MRI machine, the magnet, and we kept a tight focus because we thought we had to have a small bore magnet to be sure you got the right pictures. And we missed that, and Hitachi came. Then we got a better one. But that happens every day.
We're going to sprinkle some policy in, Jack. Do you support the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement?
Well, I support trade agreements, absolutely. I mean, the more free trade we have, the better off we are. We're the most innovative country in the world. We continue to have the only place in the world where money meets inventions in the easiest way possible. I was at South by Southwest a month ago. That's that Austin, Texas show, if you will, where entrepreneurs from everywhere come with their ideas and venture capitalists sit on the other side of the room and listen to their pitches. That doesn't happen outside of Paris. That doesn't happen in Bonn. That doesn't happen in China. That happens here. And we have it, whether it's in South by Southwest now, it's being copied in Jacksonville with One Spark. Being copied in Chicago. Everybody's trying to start incubators. It's wonderful. And so we have the innovation. We have the new products. We ought to be, based on our brains, be able to participate successfully in trade.
Specifically, President Obama supports this trade agreement, and the Congress is giving him a royally hard time on it. Do you support the president on this?
Yes.
How do you feel today about the concept of culling the herd? And maybe tell everybody what culling the herd...
2017?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This usually comes up a little earlier. culling the herd is differentiating employees by high performance, steady middle performance, and poor performance. Some people go 20-70-10, some people go ABC, some companies do other things. It's called stack ranking in some places, rank and yank in other places. Journalists have a party with it. They have a party with it. What it basically is, if you believe, again, back to my earlier remarks, business is a game. The team that fields the best players wins. And when you win, winning is good. Everybody participates, everybody grows, compensation accrues to lots of people. That's why you do it. So we were talking at Google the other day about how many people they have to let go a year, they had a number. They don't do it this way, they do it another way. But nevertheless, there's a book out now by Laszlo, who's got a work rules Google book, how Google works. They call it the bottom 5%, but it's the same thing. Who knows what the right number is? But you've got to be constantly upgrading your team, constantly hiring better people, because the team of the best players wins. Now, the thing that people miss on the way we do it, and the way we do it in our 24 private equity companies now, we have, I manage 24 companies in private equity now. We basically use that chart I showed you before. Values on one axis, numbers on the other. Most stack rankings are done by numbers. Mm-hmm. You got lousy numbers, you missed, you're out. Mm-hmm. No, that's not the way you do it. And even at Google, when we talked about it, and I talked to them about the two axes, we're not spending enough time on the left-hand axis, was their comment. So you got to have the values be part of who you keep and who you don't keep. The jerks who make the numbers. Getting a guy with great numbers and is a jerk, better to have him out of there than it is to have a solid, real performer who's getting average numbers on your team.
And so if I could just, you know, paraphrase real quickly, that nobody, there's no hand-wringing about the fact that a professional baseball manager or coach of a football team gets rid of the worst players on the team, whatever the reasons are, that they're not the best players, right. They're gone. But this, it's a, and you haven't softened that you basically feel the same way about the bottom end
Stronger. Performers
in business.
Now, you don't throw them out. You don't go in the night with a machine gun.
Right.
You tell them, no, the biggest problem is, here's why it works in sports. Let me tell you why it works in sports. You open the San Francisco Chronicle or any paper you're at, and you look at the stats. And you see who's batting 110 in baseball. You see who's got an ERA of 10 versus an ERA of 2. The numbers are all there. It's transparent. That's what this book is about, the book that we're talking about today. That book is all aimed at transparency, making employees know where they stand. The reason why it doesn't work in corporations, people are holding on to where people really stand. They don't. It's the same old story. The recession comes in 2008. The boss at the top, the CEO, yells, "We got to get 20% out of the cost structure right away." What do you do right away when you have troubles? You take people out, right? That's the fastest cost that goes out. The employee walks down the hall, the manager, and says, "Mary, it's time for you to go." And Joe, it's time for you to go. And they look up and say, "Why am I going? Well, you're the worst employee we've had here." And they look at him like, "What?" They had no, they haven't been told. So what happens? They look up and say, "If I am, I've been here 35 years and nobody's ever mentioned it to me. That's cruelty." And the boss says, "I'm too kind to ever tell her she was terrible." Yeah. "I'm too kind." That's how managers are kind. That's what they call themselves. Yeah. They're cruel. They're vicious because those people are vulnerable. And then in a recession, they can't get a job anywhere. You can coach them out. You can give them confidence and send them on their way. But I'll tell you, this idea of transparency. I used to do this 4 times a year, a little note card. Here's what I like about what you're doing. Here's what you can do to improve. Handwritten, 15 minutes, sit in front of the employee, and we'll talk about it. 4 times. You got to keep doing it. You got to let everybody know what they're doing well, what they can do to improve, and where their trajectory can take them. That is your job. You have no right to be a manager and call yourself kind because you won't tell people where they stand. It's criminal. You got to be ashamed of yourself.
Jack, a technology question for you. I'm going to read the
whole thing. That'll be good.
No, you're going to like this one. I'm going to read the whole thing. Texting versus emailing versus old-fashioned phone call. when is it appropriate or not to text or email instead of a phone call? And this questioner writes in parentheses, I prefer the phone call.
I'm an emailer from a distance a lot. My texting is with kids maybe primarily. But I think, look, more personal contact wins. The silliest thing of all is when you got two people in two offices adjacent to each other, emailing each other. I mean, that's the dumbest thing ever.
It's been known to happen.
Right. Yeah. It does happen. Yeah. It's stupid. I mean, what do you want in business? You want an emotional connection. You want people turned on to the mission. You want to get in their skin. Your job as a lead leader is really chief meeting officer. What is the purpose of them coming in every day? Why are they there? It's your job to make it real. And you can't make it real with artificial devices. So you've got to have lots and lots of personal contact. That's why there are great coaches in sports. And there are some lousy coaches in sports. But you got to get in the skin of the people and give them work meaning, not just a check, meaning. Now, it's easier in a medical business to give it meaning, where people are saving lives. It's harder in a motor business to make that clear. But you can make it so that it's more productive, the other company, the customer's more productive, you're creating jobs, and more people and families are doing better. You can make meaning out of every job. And we say the number one job of a leader right now is be chief meaning officer in a time like this.
We're going to go from technology to science. Now, I have no idea about the veracity of the implication of this question, but you will. The question is, do you still think human-caused global warming is a, quote, neurosis? And if so, what is your evidence?
I never called it a neurosis. I called it difficult to prove.
And you're not impressed by the volumes of scientists
because I believe they have. And I'd give you one of these piles on the other side. I don't think it's proven yet. This is a tough thing to say in San Francisco.
I have an even tougher one to ask you next, and I'm hiding behind the fact that somebody else is asking this, not me. Any advice on love? I have the card to prove that someone asked.
No, that's fine. Yeah, and I wish my wife were here. It took me a while to get it perfect, and I got it perfect, and I'm the happiest guy in the world.
I think that deserves a round of applause, though. And we will ask the technical staff to clip that and send it to Susie in a small file by email. We're going to keep shifting gears, Jack. What recommendations do you have for young professionals considering whether to invest in graduate school or an MBA? And I interpret this to mean some sort of humanities graduate type program versus a business program.
That depends totally. If they want to be a professor of history, I'd go humanities. If they want to be in business, I'd go for an MBA. But it's a very personal decision on what their ultimate career objective is.
How do you think Governor Jerry Brown's mandatory water restrictions will impact California's ability to attract new business?
I made a resolution when I landed in San Francisco a couple days ago to not discuss water. I don't have the foggiest idea what to do with water. Everybody's tried everything, and I don't have the answer. I've got enough papers in my briefcase on water that I don't know the answer.
You're reading on it?
Yes.
Because you're interested?
Yeah. And I was coming here. And I decided after reading and reading and reading, and I got briefing papers and all that stuff, I'm not qualified to speak on the subject.
Fair enough. And I'll pivot that to give us your sense about regulation, and it's sort of a two-part question. One, put on your large corporate CEO hat on regulation. And number two, share with everybody the experiences you've had promoting your book, talking to small business people about it.
Well, the real surprise I've gotten on regulation has come from big corporations get regulation, and they have staffs and lawyers, and they can handle it. I mean, it's a burden. It costs a lot of money. Financial Services had to get out of the finance business because the regulations overwhelm them, and they don't want to play in that field anymore because they can make better returns outside of finance now. You know, we used to have 100 banks a year formed. In the last 5 years, we've had, in the last 4 years, we've had four banks formed.
Yeah, but we
get 100 a year.
In that time, we had a lot of bad banks form and a lot of bad bankers screw them up, right?
No, they haven't. In the last 5 years, I'm talking about, the regulations are now, the banking, I didn't make that point for any other reason other than how tough it is in banking now to play. And I'm familiar with EPA and what they do to big companies and all that stuff. And
you're very familiar with the EPA.
Right. I'm familiar with all the Obamacare, et cetera, okay? But what surprised me on this trip is, as I signed books for people, a lady in Kansas City ran a small jewelry store. And she has the labor department in there challenging her on overtime pay versus non-overtime pay in a jewelry store. And she's crippled by it because they get all kinds of audits going back 10 years. It's a three-person jewelry store. And the amount of regulation that is seeping into every corner. Of course, I could repeat that story in every city I was in. There was a McDonald's franchisee who they're trying to make the franchisees pay the same wages as the franchisor, the headquarters wages. For a guy in Tupelo, it's actually Greenville, Georgia, who had to pay the same for his McDonald's employees as they do in Chicago at headquarters by this new law, which is trying to grab franchisees and encompass them in the franchisor. So everywhere you went, there was another regulation, government getting more and more into every corner of the business. And it's just, it's you can see why we're not growing. There's lots of reasons, but that's sure as hell one of them.
And not to follow up, not for this to seem to be too simplistic, but you've dealt over time with all the senior government officials in the United States. Really, what should we do about it?
We ought to have much more control over the departments, whether it be this labor or this other one or this other one. We ought to have much more control, and we ought to ask the question, is this hurting employment or helping employment? And we ought to consider then what are the implications on the other side of it, and have a balanced view of employment versus non-employment. That's the game, in my view.
Just to push back a little bit, we have all the control in the world. Congress can pass any law it wants. It can rewrite the regulatory framework for any agency it wants. Furthermore, the president can issue executive orders, even though people howl when he does. So, you know, we get to change whatever we want, but we don't. So what should we do?
I'm not going to what I would do is elect a different administration.
That's why he's Jack Welch. He answers the question. All right, we're going to go to GE. As a 16-year GE alumni, I valued the functional and leadership skill set learned by being moved from business to business. Silicon Valley seems to value domain expertise over leadership skill sets. Are the guidelines different in tech?
No, I think they're the same. I think that many domain experts in GE stayed in their domain and grew with that domain. Aircraft engines, power turbines. The more high tech it was, the more they stayed where they were.
Mm-hmm. It's a long question. I'm going to read you just the first part of it because I think it'll be sufficient. What are your views on GE's new model of getting out of the financial area? Could you have done better to maintain GE's standing in commercial paper as a dominant holding in money market funds?
You know, we'll never know. This is now, that was then, regarding me. GE's the only company that's still in the Dow Jones 120 years after it was formed. It's the only company still alive. So they've changed with the times to stay there. Now they're making a significant change in financial services because the playing field doesn't look as good, and they're going to where they can play and make more money, in their opinion. So with that record, I hope if they keep changing at the right time, they'll be here 120 years from now. So to say anything else makes no sense.
And that fact you led with, you're proud of that, aren't you, the fact that GE has been around as long as it has been?
Yep.
But tell everybody how you approach being the retired CEO. In other words, what involvement do you have with the company?
Well, I'll tell you in great detail. I left on September 7th, launched that book, and have never been back in the office in 15 years, not even across the threshold. I rarely talk to the people there. It's their sandbox to play in. My predecessor taught me that. He did the exact same thing with me. And I think it's the only way to do it. The worst thing an ex-CEO can do is sit around and pine and get their heart broken every day. Oh, my God, they did this. Oh, my God, and they fired Mary. They fired Joe, and I love Joe. And, you know, no, you can't do it. I was there. I had my time in the sandbox. I loved it. I loved the people. And I'm proud of the record that we all had, but hanging around is not for me.
And do you go so far as to actively avoid, you know, hearing the gossip and
yes.
you want to
I don't want any part of it.
Because of the heartache or the turn.
No, I don't want to get involved. I just don't want to be in there. I got my own things. I got 24 companies. We've had 74 in our private equity life. I've got a school that I spend most of my time on. I got lots of things. I got a great wife. It's all fun. Why do I want to hang around and wring my hands over what they're doing?
Which is a segue, Jack, to your book and so much of your speaking is about how to manage your career. Would you give everybody some general advice on how to manage your retirement? I mean, clearly you're not doing a very good job of retiring. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have a chapter in the book, Don't Retire, Reinvent. I mean, why would you want to retire? This game is too much fun. Start new things, try new things. I don't care what your hobbies are, make them your profession now. Go do things. Don't end up sitting around watching Ellen DeGeneres. I must admit, I got that line from Meg Whitman last night because she and I were asked by a gentleman named Andrew Ross Sorkin. We were talking about second acts, and Meg talked about the devastation of losing an election, and you can see how hard that must be. It's you. And she talked about sitting in the room, and her husband, who's a surgeon at Stanford, came in and saw her sitting there watching a TV show. And he went, holy Christ, is this what's coming to now? Is this the end for me? Yeah. And she said it was tough. And now she's out doing Hewlett Packard and thriving. But I stole that line from her last night.
It's a good one. How do you quantify the performance of non-revenue-generating employees?
Oh, simply by how much they assist the revenue-generating employees.
By how much they assist?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. The value add to the other people.
It's a subjective measure, though,
right.
Obviously.
Totally.
Right?
And look, most of them, when we say 20, 70, 10, a big part of that is subjective, okay?
Do you have...
Is there a time we must sit here?
7 minutes
okay.
Left to go.
No, I was just wondering. I don't want everybody to walk out. We'd be sitting here talking to each other.
It's very considerate of you, but I promise we won't do that to them. So just a few more, and I'll try to make them as...
Look, see what
yeah.
happened?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. For the radio audience, after Jack said that, one person got up and walked away. She's had enough. Or she has a meeting with her boss right now, and she needs to get back to
right.
the office.
Let's assume that.
Okay. Jack, many companies have value statements that seem generic or empty. How do you have meaningful values that truly guide behavior?
Because you decide, for example, let's take a GE of 30 years ago. It had silos. George Stathakis is here. He ran the nuclear division in San Jose, California. He would no more talk to somebody in Cleveland lighting or somewhere else than jump off the moon, okay? He had his own company, if you will. Everybody was in a silo. So one of the first things I did was I put a value in boundaryless behavior. Guys like George would hide his good people in reviews so you couldn't steal them to give them to another business. That's how it worked. And so we made a value, boundaryless behavior. That means you share your people, you share your ideas, and you demonstrate it. And people that weren't boundaryless were actually let go of the company. Because that behavior, why be a multi-business company if you're all in silos by yourself? You might as well be 15 companies. You want the intellectual capacity of the company to work across boundaries. We were one of the only conglomerates to ever do that, to make it a badge of honor to promote people to other divisions, to share ideas, do all that. So that's a value that helps you get more successful. Speed. We had a value of speed. So somebody would take it forever. Oh, come back, let's look at it again. Wait a minute, come on. We don't want to look at that again. Or we had another value, hate bureaucracy and all the bureaucrats who practice it. And we printed that. So somebody would come in with a presentation with 2 inches of data and boring, numbing slides. You know, you'd sit there, is that bureaucracy or what? We'd say, right in the room, call them on it. So people learn how to behave. But you've got to make it meaningful to the actions that are going to improve the company.
I think you may be happy to know I have 2 more questions left for you.
No, I'm fine saying it, but I don't want everybody walking out. it's very bad for the ego.
They're both pretty personal questions. The first one, and these are both from the audience, by the way. The first one is, what has been your most inspiring and challenging moment in your career or life?
Well, I think the most inspiring has to be around my career. It has to be the success that all of us enjoyed as a team in GE. I mean, we were the most admired for 10 years in a row in your magazine. We were all those things. And when you're winning and the stock is going up, I'll tell you a story. I mean, we used to sit on Friday nights and we'd get those IBM runouts, you know, those print sheets, those wide IBM tabs that would come out, and it would show employees and their stock options during the week. And you'd have an engineer in Cleveland in lighting making $85,000, and they'd cash in $600,000, and we'd be sitting around looking at those. We got a kick out of it. And they made $600,000 on a Friday. We'd all high-five and say, what a weekend they're going to have, you know? I mean, all that stuff with all the people winning, it was like being in the winner's locker room every day. And that was just the most exciting thing you could have. We were all friends. We vacation together. We hang out together. We break every rule of business, but we had the greatest time in the world.
And
they're all running companies now.
Here's the final question, Jack, and I'll tell you that this is from a JWMI student. That's the Jack Welch Management Institute.
Yeah.
It's a nice, flattering one to end our session with. How do you keep yourself so motivated to be able to spread the passion that you do every day? How do you choose what to invest your time in from the many things you do between work, promotion, and life?
I love to learn. I love the questions we got today. We got a question today about what did I miss? What scientific breakthrough did I miss? I never thought of that before. That's something to go back and think about. I mean, and I meet people everywhere I go. I think a book tour is without question the greatest thing in the world, and everybody should experience it. Because you get to see people all over the place and talk about their stories and their troubles and their successes. And it's an enormous turn-on. And it's fun. I love the school. The school is fun because I see these people that are changing their lives. I mean, you can't believe what's happening in every city. I've bumped into 2 or 3 JWMI people. And their stories are breathtaking. I mean, they're big raises, big promotions. That's what it's all about. Better lives.
And so for all the things that Jack Welch has said today, the quote that I will think about on my way back to the office is, I love to learn. And so I will ask you to hold your applause for some final comments and this glorious bang of the gavel. I want to thank Jack Welch, former chairman and CEO of General Electric and co-author of The Real Life MBA, your no BS guide to winning the game, building a team, and growing your career. We also thank our audiences, both here in San Francisco and on radio, television, and the internet. A reminder to everyone here that Jack Welch's book is for sale and that he'll be signing copies in the fireside room right after the program. I'm Adam Leshinsky, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.